All right, so I have my recording started, and since we said we were going to first have, before we start the second part of the class, we'll have Julie read her scripture. So let's go ahead and do that, and then we'll take it from there afterwards. Yeah, you have all your audience back, Julie. The whole two audience members, we all here. So, Julie, what is the passage you're going to read for us, and what version?
Oh, you're muted, Julie.
Minor technicality.
That's okay. You know, I have been doing that so many times, so I thought he actually told me I was muted.
And you couldn't read lips?
You know, I've tried to make you do that a few times, but I guess you should be an expert in that by now.
Okay.
So what's the passage you're going to read?
Just kidding.
I'm not close to the camera enough to really see.
I was messing with you. It's Romans 5, 1 through 11.
5, 1 to 11. Okay, what version?
Oh, NAB, New American Bible.
Okay. All right, go ahead whenever you're ready.
Okay,
before you start, could you adjust your camera so we can see a little bit more than your head?
You know, I don't know how to do that. It's
okay.
A very old MacBook.
I see. Is it a laptop?
Yes.
Okay, could you just move the top part
closer to me?
Yeah.
Like that?
Yep, keep going. No, not closer, but kind of like you were closing it. Don't close it, but just pull it forward toward you.
Like that?
Yep, there you go.
Hi. I have a body, not just a
yes.
head.
Yes.
It's just not a head sitting on a table.
Yeah, and the reason I noticed that is I was looking at my video from last week because I wanted to make sure that it worked. Some student reported that they couldn't play it. And for the first part, when I was doing the question part, I thought I only see my black, really the top of my head right here. I could barely see my lip, really, because it's just like so... Only my head. It's just like a talking head. So, so I said, oh, my goodness. I did not realize that. So
I noticed it, but I thought maybe that's just the way he wants it. So, okay.
No, that's not the way I wanted it. I was probably just thinking about other thing, and that did not come to mind. So now I do want you to see as much of me as possible, which is what I'm going to be asking for everyone online as well to do,
okay,
so that I can at least see your gestures if possible when you speak.
Okay, so now you know it's not just a bust on a table.
Right? Exactly.
A talking bust.
Right. Okay, so go ahead.
Okay. Therefore, since we have been justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, to whom we have gained access by faith to his grace in which we stand, and we boast in hope of the glory of God. Not only that, but we have even boast of our afflictions, knowing that affliction produces endurance, and endurance proven character, and proven character hope, and hope does not disappoint, because the love of God has been poured out into our hearts through the Holy Spirit that has been given to us. For Christ, while we were still helpless, yet he died at the appointed time for the ungodly. Indeed, only with difficulty does one die for a just person, perhaps a good person, one might even find courage to die. But God proves his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. How much more then, since we are now justified by his blood, will we be saved through him from the wrath? Indeed, if, while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of his Son, how much more, once reconciled, will we be saved by his life? Not only that, we also boast of God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have now received reconciliation.
Good.
Thank you.
And again, the rate was good, not too fast, and I don't think it was too slow either, since Anthony brought that up earlier. So wanted to ask him what he thought.
Yeah, it was good. Good flow, good rhythm.
Very good. All right, so we have two scriptures tonight.
Thank you.
That's 2 out of 17.
Oh man.
I was getting a little leery that we were going to have only 1 out of 17. So I feel much better now that we have 2 out of 17.
I didn't want Anthony to be the Lone Ranger.
Good. So thank you for doing this and at this getting this part done. So now you only have to worry about doing the actual one page description and paper for that. So
okay.
Have one thing done at least.
Woo.
Woo-hoo. All right, so let's go ahead and get this starting here for the second part. All right, so we need to talk about presenting your speech, which basically what we'll be looking at in this chapter, the things that you need to consider in terms of delivery methods. Many of you would be probably decide to use different methods, but I'll tell you what my preference, delivery method preference would be that I'd like you to use. And we'll talk a little bit about the importance of really portray yourself non-verbally in terms of how your non-verbal complement your verbal. And the video that I'd like you to watch at the end has to do with how your non-verbal really affect the way you see yourself and the way other people see you. And in public speaking, really, you have to pay attention to how you are portraying yourself physically and non-verbally. It's not just what you say, it's how you say it and how it is said. So, and also how what your non-verbal is saying compared to what your mouth is saying as well. So when those things contradict each other, then we have a problem. So I wanted to at least see the science behind that because this is based on studies, real science, scientific studies. I wanted to at least get you to interact with that video at the end. So which means we probably try to go We have about an hour, and the video itself is 21 minutes, so we better get going here. All right, so let's talk about delivery methods, okay? There are four delivery methods that are talked about in your text. We talk about the first one is when you read from a script. We call it manuscript or reading. This method is quite popular, especially with people who don't feel really comfortable about, you know, speaking using just regular note instead of a script. So people feel comfortable when they have everything written out word for word. They're not afraid that they are going to forget what they need to say. Now, let me ask you though, what are some of the disadvantages that you can see with using a script when it comes to interacting with the audience, you know, being really getting the audience feedback into your speech and make it more do on the spot adaptation? What are some of the limitations that you can see based on those things with a manuscript?
I think some of it could become so so mechanical and robotic that you're just reading and, you spend all your time reading and looking at the paper that you're reading from. You're not aware of your audience, and you can't really get their buy-in, get the participation, know what's going on. And so the awareness piece, I think, is something that could be limited.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the type of speech. I hope I get the word right. It's a really long word. Extemporaneous?
We'll get there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I was
thinking. Yeah, so manuscript. Basically, there are some advantages, but some of the disadvantages that you pointed out, those are correct. Now, you can, however, because one of the things that you may be lacking quite a bit if you're not familiar enough with your text, which means you are glued to it, eye contact would definitely suffer. Now, if you practice enough with your reading, you can still make enough eye contact that it's not going to be, you know, such a detriment to your presentation. You can at least kind of make this your method that you adopt.
Mm-hmm.
And really work at it so that you're not glued to the text and too much that you can't make enough eye contact. You can work that out. The term that you said, being mechanical, most people do not read with a conversational voice.
Right.
And this is also something you can work at, so that when you read, it almost sounds like you are talking instead of reading.
Yeah.
So you can work yourself, you can work your way, you can practice it enough so that it sounds natural, more natural than just reading, which most people don't do. They as long as they read, you can tell they're reading because it's really mechanical, as you mentioned earlier.
And there's a risk here with if someone else is controlling the projection equipment, they could go faster or slower than you and throw you off, and that just throw everything off and you just stumble and you have to quickly, you know.
Right.
Get back in your lane.
Exactly. So advantages would be, obviously, you have everything in front of you. You're not afraid to that you're going to forget what you're going to say. This is basically a security blanket for most people who adopt this, the manuscript method. You use that for the most part. I mean, you tend to stay on time, though, as well. because everything is there. You're not ad-libbing. you know, you have, if you practice at a certain rate of speaking, then, and you present with that same rate in the real, during the real time, then you probably would be able to stay at the right time because you know exactly how long your presentation is and how much information you have on there. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Now, there are times when it is absolutely necessary to use a manuscript. And those are some of the situations that are listed in here for you. According to Roger Axtell, he writes a very small book. I think I probably mentioned it before. His Do's and Taboos of Public Speaking, I think. So words are absolutely necessary to be correct. If you are giving a brief on TV, on television, you know, talking about a crisis, you don't want to be misquoted. You want to make sure your words are exactly what you intended, what you prepared, so that people don't misquote you, then manuscript would be most appropriate at that point. When you have less, you don't have a lot of time to really practice and rehearse and commit this information, part of it to memory and things like that, the script probably will save you there when you don't have a lot of time to prepare to do it, one of the other methods that you were going to be looking at. I like this one. They said, when different speeches must be presented in one day to different audience, that can be a challenge for you to try to do one of the other two methods that ask you more to be really comfortable with the information in your head somewhat so that you can present without a complete screen. Script. So there are good things about script and there are some limitations. I just want you to be aware of those things. And I do want you to know that I'm not encouraging you to use this method because I do want you to be able to interact with the audience, be able to get the audience feedback and apply, do on-the-spot adaptation if possible. And you often cannot do that very well with a script, already prepared script, where you're reading word for word everything, okay? So there are ways to master it, and there are times when it is most effective to use. But for our case, in our classroom situation, I would not recommend that's the method you use for this. You can use it at other places, okay? The other one is memorization, all right? So obviously, we've done a memorization, scripture memorization before, and some of you, I'm sure, probably do not like that very much. No, so way. I'm not concerned that you are going to memorize your speech for our classroom, because we're not recommending that either, okay? Because some of the same things that we identified with manuscript delivery can also be applicable with memorization. One is you tend to be mechanical, and because you're trying to remember word for word what you studied, then it is possible that you may not be able to interact as well with the audience, because if you might be afraid that interacting with the audience, taking the feedback and apply and do on-the-spot adaptation may throw you off from your memorization.
Yeah.
So you may be concerned about that. Okay. So sometimes, again, you may want to memorize if you're giving a short. For example, when we're going to be talking about speeches of celebration or ceremonial speeches, and one of those is toast. Okay, if you go and giving a toast, which usually in itself is supposed to be brief, it may be that it's not long enough for you not to remember it. Therefore, you might want to just memorize it. It may work well because it's short and you're able to really make eye contact with the audience. And if you have notes, maybe very brief notes so that you're not glued to it anyway. So you may want to do memorization for those brief things, but not long speeches, unless you have really mastered that and you memorize, but it doesn't even look like it's for memory and you're able to adapt with this, the audience, you have really mastered that method, then by no means, you know, use it for other things. But for classroom speeches, I'm not asking you to memorize your speech. This is the one that I'm asking you to do, is extemporaneous. This is the word you are looking for, Julie. Okay, yeah. Extemporaneous is the other method that most speeches and most occasion utilize. And it's a combination of script and memorization. Because in an extemporaneous delivery method, you may decide that you want to memorize your introduction, or you may decide you want to memorize your conclusion, or both, okay? Memorizing your introduction is actually a good thing because you're able to really connect with eye contact immediately with the audience at the beginning. And once you do that, which is an important aspect, because once you connect with the audience at the beginning, then you have a better chance of keeping them engaged and glued to you through the speech. But if you lose them in the first few minutes because you didn't connect with them that way, then you may have a harder time get them back. So give and take in both of them. So extemporaneous, you have notes. That is where the third outline that we talked about, the keyword outline, this is where this would be used in an extemporaneous method, which means you don't have your formal outline where almost all your information is on there. That's why we said you may consider rehearsing with your formal outline at the beginning. And then once you feel familiar enough with the information where you don't have to read it anymore, then you can move on into the keyword outline where you know what your introduction is, you know what your conclusion is, you know the main points that you're going to advance, and you know what type of supporting material you're going to be using to support each of your main points. And those can be part of your keyword outline, okay? So maybe one word, it may be a phrase for each of the supporting points or a phrase for each main point. So depending on how you want to organize that, things that help you, that trigger your memory in terms of what the next thing's going to be that you're going to be talking about. If you use the extemporaneous method, you tend to sound more naturally, which means you're not reading and you didn't memorize everything either. So therefore, you're able to interact with the audience, you're able to take their feedback and do on-the-spot adaptation if necessary, which makes the speech more alive, more lively, and then the audience feels more part of the presentation that way, okay? So this is mostly recommend for most occasions for extemporaneous, but again, those other methods, they have their places as well. And depending on how familiar, how comfortable you feel with them, okay? Impromptu is there as another delivery method, but it's not at the same level as the first three, because impromptu, it's basically situational, I would say. Impromptu is basically on the spot, on the off the cuff. You are asked to speak about something that you did not prepare for, okay? Most of you have participated in meetings at work, or, you know, a friend calls you and asks you a question about something you didn't even know they were going to be asking you a question about. That would be examples of impromptu. I ask you to do a 2-minute speech at the beginning of first week and the first week. Well, you didn't even know what topic you were going to be talking about. You are going to be asked to speak on. You called, you hear the prompt, you had 30 seconds to gather your thought. That's not a lot of time to make a lot of preparation. Yeah. So what are some of the techniques for those? Is really quickly organize a few ideas. You're not expected to be perfect. You're not expected to be polished in those impromptu speeches because they know you didn't have a lot of time. But if you have put together, applied some principles, you quickly hear the idea, you quickly in your head identify, okay, what are two or three things that I want to say about this, and then finding ways to support each of them. You can still do good organization even with an impromptu speech, even though you did not have an elaborate a lot of time to prepare and rehearse or anything like that. So when I ask you a question in class that you did not even know that I was going to ask you, and you answer and give a good thoughtful answer, that is impromptu. Okay, so it's on the different level than the first three methods that we just identified. Now let me go very quickly. No matter what method you're going to be using, nonverbal is important. Okay. Peter Drucker said, the most important thing in communication is to hear what is not being said.
So what you're seeing.
Okay.
What you're seeing, what's being left out of the speech.
Exactly. Because not everything, communication is not just about what you hear. It's also what you see. If I were speaking behind your back and I ask you not to look at me when I'm what I speak, I make you face the other way, and I have someone that I'm speaking to, and I'm making all those gestures with my hand that indicate you're a jerk, but I'm saying a lot of nice words. You're only hearing the nice words, but you're not seeing the gestures that I'm making, yeah. And you probably would only, not even half of the communication, of the meaning of what I'm saying, you would not even get that.
Yeah.
So it is important to pay attention to not just the word that are spoken, but also the nonverbal. So what is the body language of the speaker saying to you? there's this discussion, when verbal and nonverbal symbols don't match, listeners tend to assign more importance to the nonverbal. If you say, you know, I am so honored. I am so happy to be here to speak with you. But you're frowning. Your face doesn't show any, it's not lightened up. It's not bright. And then you're saying those things, but you are communicating something completely different non-verbally. Your words say you're happy to be here. You're honored to be there. But non-verbally, you're saying, nah, not really. Okay. So all of those are things that you need to be paying attention to as the speaker, because those contradict your verbal and therefore they send mixed messages to the audience that you are addressing. 60% of our communication is nonverbal, according to Edward Hall. Okay. Now, that means only 40% are based on the words that we speak. Now, Albert Mehrabian breaks that down even further. You know, there are some type of communication, some types of message that you communicate that deals a lot with feelings, you know, how you feel about things. And those messages, particularly the words themselves, speak very little about the emotion. Okay. We could take a quick example. You walk home from work. I mean, you got home from work and you look really dejected and tired and frustrated. And your spouse asks, "Honey, how was your day?" And you said, "It was fine."
Not going to work.
Good. I'm glad you know that. It was fine. Okay. So those messages are messages of emotions. They are not communicated well just by the words themselves. The nonverbal, the way you say those words, the way you carry yourself, the way you use gestures and so forth, all those have to come together to create a full meaning of the message. It's the same thing in actual speech that you're giving. As I took the example saying that, you know, "I'm happy to be here," but your face is saying, "Nah, not really," you know. So 7% of message pertaining to feelings and attitude is in the words that are spoken, according to Albert Mehrabian. Those are basically saying very little of the word. 38% of message pertaining to feelings and attitudes is paralinguistic. That has to do with the way you say things, your verbal, your tone of voice. If you are excited, it comes out through your voice. If you are angry, if you are frustrated, it comes through your voice. Okay? Those are emotional events that you're communicating through things other than the words themselves. And then 55% of message pertaining to feelings and attitudes is in facial expression. Your face is the most communicative part of your body. Okay, so when you are communicating, you're thinking, "Oh man, I am really getting this word across," and then your face, your voice, they are communicating things that are completely different from the words that you spoke. And believe it or not, the audience will not believe your word anymore. They believe more what they can see versus what you are telling them. Because a lot of those things, often people don't recognize that they have more control over the words than they are over those emotions or those nonverbal cues that they are sending out. So they have to match. Yeah. Your verbal needs to match your nonverbal. And if your verbal does not match your nonverbal, then the audience will believe the nonverbal. Because you tend to have less control over that. Okay, so what are some of the things that you can do when it comes to showing physically so that your physical matches your verbal, your nonverbal, and so forth? Speakers must learn how to be physically relaxed to allow their actions to complement their words, which means you have to learn how to not showing emotions that you did not even intend to show just because of the way you carry yourself. You showing that you're really nervous when you're saying, when you want to say you are not, or you saying that you're comfortable when all the gestures you're doing, you look awkward, you use your hands awkwardly, you move awkwardly, you're trying to pace too fast, which makes the audience go like this, trying to keep up with you. You know, all those are physical things in speech delivery that need to be controlled and understand. Okay, and understand how not to give those vibes. Okay, so eye contact. If you say you really enjoy speaking to this audience, but you can't look them in the eye, you are sending mixed message. Okay, so you need to learn how? I'm not asking you to stare people down. Okay. There's a difference. But acknowledge them in the room. Don't just look to the back of the room and over everybody's head instead of, you know, connecting with them through eye contact. So this is one of the physical aspects that often beginners in public speaking, often they just don't feel like they can make themselves make eye contact with an audience. Yeah. And so we need to work on that. If that is a problem for some of you, work on that, because people get connected with you when they can see you, or when you connect with them through eye contact. You're showing that you care, and you're showing that you want to be there. You're showing that you want them to be involved in the message you're communicating. So use eye contact to connect with the audience as much as possible. And then the last thing I wanted to look at, there are other things in terms of your voice, your rate at which you speak, the volume that you need to control. You have to understand how your pitch, you know, how high or how low your voice is. Those kind of things are still part of the verbal part, how you use your voice to communicate. And I don't have enough time to really go over all of those, but I do want to at least point to those things that contribute to you having an effective presentation. Okay. Eye contact help you create what we call immediacy with the audience. If you see someone have a puzzled look on their face after you make a statement, it can communicate that they did not understand. How do you take that statement, that feedback, and adapt it by giving another example because of that look you see, look of confusion? Is the person trying to strain, you know, cupping his or her ear because they can't hear you? Then that means you need to speak louder. Are you able to, you know, move away from your podium and get closer to the audience? Now, I'm not saying that is possible in all settings, in all occasions. There are times when you cannot just, the place where you are doesn't allow, give you that opportunity to do it. But if you're able to walk around and connect with the audience in different part of the room, this is what we mean by immediacy. The audience feels part of the message. They can connect very much, very well with you. So make sure to combine verbal and nonverbal communication to create meanings, because only words do not communicate your full message. The nonverbals need to be there.
What about breathing? Like if you need to take a deep breath to just, you know, kind of reset, refresh, refocus, is that something that kind of portrays a negative or positive, you know?
Okay. So often what makes you take a deep breath?
Probably anxiety,
maybe
you're just frustrated with the way you're just going or something like that.
Right. I would not do it too often.
Okay.
You know, I would not, you know, after every you know, few sentences, I'm taking a deep breath.
Right. You know?
but it may be okay. Like the audience probably would not frown on that too much if before you start, you know, just to calm your nerves a little bit, because when you take a deep breath and release very slowly, it does get you a little more relaxed.
Okay.
So at the beginning, it may be okay, But if you keep doing that throughout the speech, then it probably become a little bit too much.
Okay.
Okay?
Great.
So you need to show the audience that the message is important, whether it's informative speech you're giving or a persuasive speech. Your role as the speaker is to let the audience see what's the value of this information for them. And this is why I don't want you to just select a topic just because it's easy and you can just talk about it without any effort if it's not going to be seen as meaningful to the audience. So you have to keep that in mind. So you have to show the audience why should they listen to this information? What is it they're going to learn from it? What is it they're going to need to do afterwards? So this is your role as a speaker to make that happen. Okay. And part of that is based on your research, based on how you organize your presentation, based on the content of the message that you want the audience to hear and to get. So I need you to remember that public speaking is almost like an extended conversation. Okay. When you talk to your friends, you most likely look them in the eye, I would think. And you don't talk with your friends with your eyes down, head down, just looking down the entire time. You do look them in the eye, and you talk with them. You don't lecture them, you talk to them, you have a conversation with them, right?
Right.
Okay? So that can be almost the same thing, except you have more people that you're talking to, you're having a conversation with.
Well, that's helpful when you say it like that, an extended conversation with your friends. That kind of brings it home for us, you know.
Good. I'm glad to hear that, because I think sometimes we look at public speaking like, you know, it's obviously we do need you to be formal when it needs to be formal, but not every time you give a speech it has to be, you know, so formal that you can't really even interact with the audience, you know. So you need to understand what's the setting, what the audience you're addressing, and what is in your capacity to do based on where you are, based on the information you're presenting, based on the setting and all of that. Okay, so it's an extended conversation. You're going to make eye contact. You're going to try to integrate some jokes that even some of the audience members probably have indicated based on their reaction. Now, I don't want you to make fun of an audience member, you know, at their detriment. In fact, it's better for you to make fun of about yourself, laugh about you on your own, you know, shortfall, than at the detriment of the audience members. So, those are some of the things that I want you to keep in mind. And when it comes to how you show yourself as a speaker, your nonverbal is critical. It makes you think about how comfortable you are or how uncomfortable you are. It makes the audience see how comfortable or how uncomfortable you are based on how you present yourself non-verbally. I need to go ahead and start the video now that talks about the importance of nonverbal in terms of how you look at yourself based on your nonverbal and how other people see you based on nonverbal. This is from a social psychologist, the social scientist, I think, Amy Cuddy. And I want you to watch the video and tell me which part of the things that she talks about that you could relate to, or you have actually seen this thing, you have seen you acting this way or that way, whether it's positive or negative. I'm not looking just for the negative, and I also want to see the positive as well in terms of some of the things that she talks about and relating to nonverbal and body language, basically. Okay, so there we go.
I want to start by offering you a free no-tech life hack. And all it requires of you is this, that you change your posture.
Okay, what's happening here?
Oh, I see.
I don't know why it's not.
Oh, there she is.
For 2 minutes. But before I give it away, so I want to start by offering you a free no-tech life hack. And all it requires of you is this, that you change your posture for 2 minutes. But before I give it away, I want to ask you to right now do a little audit of your body and what you're doing with your body. So how many of you are sort of making yourself smaller? Maybe you're hunching, crossing your legs, maybe wrapping your ankles. Sometimes we hold on to our arms like this. Sometimes we spread out. I see you. So I want you to pay attention to what you're doing right now. Right now, we're going to come back to that in a few minutes, and I'm hoping that if you sort of learn to tweak that, your life unfolds. So we're really fascinated with body language, and we're particularly interested in other people's body language. You know, we're interested in, like, you know, an awkward interaction, or a smile, or a contemptuous glance, or maybe a very awkward wink, or maybe even something like a handshake.
Here they are arriving at number 10, and look, this lucky policeman gets to shake hands with the President of the United States. Oh, and here comes the Prime Minister of the... No.
So, a handshake or the lack of a handshake can have us talking for weeks and weeks and weeks, even the BBC and the New York Times. So obviously, when we think about nonverbal behavior or body language, but we call it nonverbals as social scientists, it's language. So we think about communication. When we think about communication, we think about interactions. So what is your body language communicating to me? What's mine communicating to you? And there's a lot of reason to believe that this is a valid way to look at this. So social scientists have spent a lot of time looking at the effects of our body language or other people's body language on judgments. And we make sweeping judgments and inferences from body language. And those judgments can predict really meaningful life outcomes, like who we hire or promote, who we ask out on a date. For example, Nalini Ambadi, a researcher at Tufts University, shows that when people watch 30-second soundless clips of real physician-patient interactions, their judgments of the physician's niceness predict whether or not that physician will be sued. So it doesn't have to do so much with whether or not that physician was incompetent, but do we like that person and how they interacted? Even more dramatic, Alex Todorov at Princeton has shown us that judgments of political candidates' faces in just 1 second predict 70% of US Senate and gubernatorial race outcomes. And even, let's go digital, emoticons used well in online negotiations can lead you to claim more value from that negotiation. If you use them poorly, bad idea, right? So when we think of nonverbals, we think how we judge others, how they judge us, and what the outcomes are. We tend to forget, though, the other audience that's influenced by our nonverbals, and that's ourselves. We are also influenced by our nonverbals, our thoughts and our feelings and our physiology. So what nonverbals am I talking about? I'm a social psychologist, I study prejudice, and I teach at a competitive business school. So it was inevitable that I would become interested in power dynamics. I became especially interested in nonverbal expressions of power and dominance. And what are nonverbal expressions of power and dominance? Well, this is what they are. So in the animal kingdom, they are about expanding. So you make yourself big, you stretch out, you take up space, you're basically opening up. It's about opening up. And this is true across the animal kingdom. It's not just limited to primates, and humans do the same thing. So they do this both when they have power sort of chronically, and also when they're feeling powerful in the moment. And this one is especially interesting because it really shows us how universal and old these expressions of power are. This expression, which is known as pride, Jessica Tracy has studied, she shows that people who are born with sight and people who are congenitally blind do this when they win at a physical competition. So when they cross the finish line and they've won, it doesn't matter if they've never seen anyone do it, they do this. So the arms up in the V, the chin is slightly lifted. What do we do when we feel powerless? We do exactly the opposite. We close up, we wrap ourselves up, we make ourselves small. We don't want to bump into the person next to us. So again, both animals and humans do the same thing. And this is what happens when you put together high and low power. So what we tend to do when it comes to power is that we complement the other's nonverbals. So if someone's being really powerful with us, we tend to make ourselves smaller. We don't mirror them, we do the opposite of them. So I'm watching this behavior in the classroom, and what do I notice? I notice that MBA students really exhibit the full range of power nonverbals. So you have people who are like caricatures of alphas, like really coming into the room, they get right into the middle of the room before class even starts, like they really want to occupy space. When they sit down, they're sort of spread out, they raise their hands like this. You have other people who are virtually collapsing when they come in. As soon as they come in, you see it. You see it on their faces and their bodies, and they sit in their chair and they make themselves tiny, and they go like this when they raise their hand. I noticed a couple things about this. One, you're not going to be surprised, it seems to be related to gender. So women are much more likely to do this kind of thing than men. Women feel chronically less powerful than men, so this is not surprising. But the other thing I noticed is that it also seemed to be related to the extent to which the students were participating and how well they were participating. And this is really important in the MBA classroom because participation counts for half the grade. So business schools have been struggling with this gender grade gap. You get these equally qualified women and men coming in, and then you get these differences in grades, and it seems to be partly attributable to participation. So I started to wonder, you know, okay, so you have these people coming in like this and they're participating. Is it possible that we could get people to fake it, and would it lead them to participate more? So my main collaborator, Dana Carney, who's at Berkeley, and I really wanted to know, can you fake it till you make it? Like, can you do this just for a little while and actually experience a behavioral outcome that makes you seem more powerful? So we know that our nonverbals govern how other people think and feel about us. There's a lot of evidence, but our question really was, do our nonverbals govern how we think and feel about ourselves? There's some evidence that they do. So, for example, when we smile when we feel happy, but also when we're forced to smile by holding a pen in our teeth like this, it makes us feel happy. So it goes both ways. When it comes to power, it also goes both ways. So when you feel powerful, you're more likely to do this, but it's also possible that when you pretend to be powerful, you are more likely to actually feel powerful. So the second question really was, you know, so we know that our minds change our bodies. Is it also true that our bodies change our minds? And when I say minds, in the case of the powerful, what am I talking about? So I'm talking about thoughts and feelings and the sort of physiological things that make up our thoughts and feelings. And in my case, that's hormones. I look at hormones. So what do the minds of the powerful versus the powerless look like? So powerful people tend to be, not surprisingly, more assertive and more confident, more optimistic. They actually feel that they're going to win even at games of chance. They also tend to be able to think more abstractly. So there are a lot of differences. They take more risks. There are a lot of differences between powerful and powerless people. Physiologically, there also are differences. On two key hormones, testosterone, which is the dominance hormone, and cortisol, which is the stress hormone. So what we find is that high power alpha males in primate hierarchies have high testosterone and low cortisol, and powerful and effective leaders also have high testosterone and low cortisol. So what does that mean? When you think about power, people tended to think only about testosterone because that was about dominance. But really, power is also about how you react to stress. So do you want the high power leader that's dominant, high on testosterone, but really stress reactive? Probably not, right? You want the person who's powerful and assertive and dominant, but not very stress reactive, the person who's laid back. So we know that in primate hierarchies, if an alpha needs to take over, if an individual needs to take over an alpha role sort of suddenly, within a few days, that individual's testosterone has gone up significantly and his cortisol has dropped significantly. So we have this evidence, both that the body can shape the mind, at least at the facial level, and also that role changes can shape the mind. So what happens, okay, you take a role change, what happens if you do that at a really minimal level, like this tiny manipulation, this tiny intervention, for 2 minutes you say, I want you to stand like this, and it's going to make you feel more powerful. So this is what we did. We decided to bring people into the lab and run a little experiment. And these people adopted for 2 minutes either high power poses or low power poses. And I'm just going to show you five of the poses, although they took on only two. So here's one, a couple more. This one has been dubbed the Wonder Woman by the media. Here are a couple more. So you can be standing or you can be sitting. And here are the low power poses. So you're folding up, you're making yourself small. This one is very low power. When you're touching your neck, you're really kind of protecting yourself. So this is what happens. They come in, they spit into a vial. We, for 2 minutes, say, you need to do this or this. They don't look.
Well, it looks like we're having some difficulties playing this particular video. I'm not sure why.
Experiment. So this is what we find. Risk tolerance, which is the gambling. What we find is that when you're in the high power pose condition, 86% of you will gamble. When you're in the low power pose condition, only 60%, and that's a pretty whopping significant difference. Here's what we find on testosterone. From their baseline when they come in, high power people experience about a 20% increase, and low power people. Here's what we find on testosterone. From their baseline when they come in, high power people experience about a 20% increase, and low power people experience about a 10% decrease. So again, 2 minutes and you get these changes. Here's what you get on cortisol. High power people experience about a 25% decrease, and the low power people experience about a 15% increase. So 2 minutes lead to these hormonal changes that configure your brain to basically be either assertive, confident, and comfortable, or really stress reactive, and you know, feeling sort of shut down, and we've all had that feeling, right? So it seems that our nonverbals do govern how we think and feel about ourselves. So it's not just others, but it's also ourselves. Also, our bodies change our minds. But the next question, of course, is, can power posing for a few minutes really change your life in meaningful ways? So this is in the lab, it's this little task, you know, it's just a couple of minutes. You know, where can you actually apply this, which we cared about, of course. And so we think it's really what matters, I mean, where you want to use this is evaluative situations, like social threat situations. Where are you being evaluated? Either by your friends, like for teenagers at the lunchroom table. It could be, you know, for some people, it's speaking at a school board meeting. It might be giving a pitch or giving a talk like this or doing a job interview. We decided that the one that most people could relate to because most people had been through was the job interview. So we published these findings, and the media are all over it, and they say, okay, so this is what you do when you go in for the job interview, right? You know, so we were, of course, horrified and said, oh my God, no, that's not what we meant at all for numerous reasons. No, don't do that. Again, this is not about you talking to other people, it's you talking to yourself. What do you do before you go into a job interview? You do this. Right, you're sitting down, you're looking at your iPhone or your Android, not trying to leave anyone out. You are, you know, you're looking at your notes, you're hunching up, making yourself small, when really what you should be doing maybe is this, like in the bathroom, right? Do that, find 2 minutes. So that's what we want to test, okay? So we bring people into a lab, and they do either high or low power poses again. They go through a very stressful job interview. It's 5 minutes long. They are being recorded, they're being judged also, and the judges are trained to give no nonverbal feedback. So they look like this. Like, imagine this is the person interviewing you. So for 5 minutes, nothing. And this is worse than being heckled. People hate this. It's what Marianne LaFrance calls standing in social quicksand. So this really spikes your cortisol. So this is the job interview we put them through because we really wanted to see what happened. We then have these coders look at these tapes, 4 of them. They're blind to the hypothesis, they're blind to the conditions, they have no idea who's been posing in what pose. And they end up looking at these sets of tapes and they say, oh, we want to hire these people, all the high power posers, we don't want to hire these people. We also evaluate these people much more positively overall. But what's driving it? It's not about the content of the speech, it's about the presence that they're bringing to the speech. We also, because we rate them on all these variables related to sort of competence, like how well structured is the speech, how good is it, what are their qualifications, no effect on those things. This is what's affected, these kinds of things. People are bringing their true selves, basically. They're bringing themselves. They bring their ideas, but as themselves, with no, you know, residue over them. So this is what's driving the effect or mediating the effect. So when I tell people about this, that our bodies change our minds and our minds can change our behavior and our behavior can change our outcomes, they say to me, it feels fake, right? So I said, fake it till you make it. Like, it's not me. Like, I don't want to get there and then still feel like a fraud. I don't want to feel like an imposter. I don't want to get there only to feel like I'm not supposed to be here. And that really resonated with me because I want to tell you a little story about being an imposter and feeling like I'm not supposed to be here. When I was 19, I was in a really bad car accident. I was thrown out of a car, rolled several times. I was thrown from the car, and I woke up in a head injury rehab ward, and I had been withdrawn from college, and I learned that my IQ had dropped by 2 standard deviations, which was very traumatic. I knew my IQ because I had identified with being smart, and I had been called gifted as a child. So I'm taken out of college, I keep trying to go back. They say, you're not going to finish college. Like, just, you know, there are other things for you to do, but that's not going to work out for you. So I really struggled with this, and I have to say, having your identity taken from you, your core identity, and for me it was being smart, having that taken from you, there's nothing that leaves you feeling more powerless than that. So I felt entirely powerless. I worked and worked and worked, and I got lucky and worked and got lucky and worked. Eventually, I graduated from college. It took me 4 years longer than my peers. And I convinced someone, my angel advisor, Susan Fiske, to take me on. And so I ended up at Princeton, and I was like, I am not supposed to be here. I am an imposter. And the night before my first year talk, and the first year talk at Princeton is a 20-minute talk to 20 people. That's it. I was so afraid of being found out the next day that I called her and said, I'm quitting. She was like, you are not quitting, because I took a gamble on you and you're staying. You're gonna stay, and this is what you're gonna do. You're gonna fake it. You're gonna do every talk that you ever get asked to do. You're just gonna do it and do it and do it, even if you're terrified and just paralyzed and having an out-of-body experience until you have this moment where you say, oh my gosh, I'm doing it. Like, I have become this. I am actually doing this. So that's what I did, 5 years in grad school. A few years, you know, I'm at Northwestern, I moved to Harvard. I'm at Harvard, I'm not really thinking about it anymore, but for a long time I had been thinking, not supposed to be here, not supposed to be here. So the end of my first year at Harvard, a student who had not talked in class the entire semester, who I had said, look, you gotta participate or else you're gonna fail, came into my office. I really didn't know her at all. And she said, she came in totally defeated and she said, I'm not supposed to be here. And that was the moment for me, because two things happened. One was that I realized, oh my gosh, I don't feel like that anymore, you know? I don't feel that anymore, but she does, and I get that feeling. And the second was, she is supposed to be here. Like, she can fake it, she can become it. So I was like, yes, you are. You are supposed to be here, and tomorrow you're gonna fake it, you're gonna make yourself powerful, and, you know, you're gonna... And you're gonna go into the classroom, and you are gonna give the best comment ever. You know, and she gave the best comment ever. And people turned around, they were like, oh my God, I didn't even notice her sitting there, you know? She comes back to me months later, and I realized that she had not just faked it till she made it, she had actually faked it till she became it. So she had changed. And so I want to say to you, don't fake it till you make it. Fake it till you become it. You know, it's not do it enough until you actually become it and internalize. The last thing I want to leave you with is this. Tiny tweaks can lead to big changes. So this is 2 minutes. 2 minutes, 2 minutes, 2 minutes. Before you go into the next stressful evaluative situation, for 2 minutes, try doing this in the elevator, in a bathroom stall, at your desk behind closed doors. That's what you want to do. Configure your brain to cope the best in that situation. Get your testosterone up, get your cortisol down. Don't leave that situation feeling like, oh, I didn't show them who I am. Leave that situation feeling like, oh, I really feel like I got to say who I am and show who I am. So I want to ask you first, you know, both to try power posing, and also I want to ask you to share the science, because this is simple. I don't have ego involved in this. Give it away, like share it with people, because the people who can use it the most are the ones with no resources and no technology and no status and no power. Give it to them, because they can do it in private. They need their bodies, privacy, and 2 minutes, and it can significantly change the outcomes of their life. Thank you.
For a moment there, I thought we weren't going to finish watching the video.
Yeah.
But I'm glad we kind of tweaked it and make it through. So what did you think? I asked you to think about some of the things that you could relate to as you watch, as you listen to her, and some of the things she was saying, some of the examples she was presenting. Anything in there that you could relate to or you could see that would be beneficial for you to start working on when it comes to really facing an audience?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, she had some great flow, but she just kept her ideas building off one another. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something important to do to help you stay on track, which I struggle with that sometimes. But yeah, I mean, she's very personable. She shared stories. She cried. She was emotional. And she won the audience over eventually, even though I found her in the beginning a little choppy, a little short breathed, a little rushy. She still came through, and she really, she accomplished her mission of giving that information over to the audience and really making it personable so that they can own it and leave there with a feeling of, this is something I can do, I understand it, and that's what she was really trying to do in her overall speech.
Okay.
Yeah. I like that she shared her personal story you know, as part of it, especially the part about where, about the change in her IQ, and she didn't let that defeat her.
Okay. So personally, in terms of the content of her presentation, in terms of feeling powerful or feeling powerless, which may affect the way you come across when it comes to you standing in front of an audience, none of that really, you don't feel like you relate to any of those.
Well, I think we do in a way.
Okay.
And I think it can be situational. If, you know, obviously your circumstances are going to play an effect in going before a speech.
Right.
Your first impressions of the audience and you, how well you've practiced and some of those things. But yeah, I could see how important it is for your body language and not just for your audience, but what you're doing and how you feel about it and what your body language is.
Right.
You know,
And this is the main reason I showed this video, because I know it is important for us to understand that when I stand and I look small, the audience doesn't see me conveying confidence in my ideas and my thought and what I'm communicating. And as we talked about nonverbal, if you show lack of confidence nonverbally, but you're speaking words that communicates confidence, then they conflict.
It's not as believable.
Exactly. So we need to be aware of the type of how our body language, what kind of message our body language is communicating. Is it contradicting what we are saying verbally, or do they really complement each other? Because that's what they should do. Your nonverbals should complement your verbal. They should go together. They should support each other, not detract from each other. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, our time is up, but I need to very quickly show you the evaluation form that I was talking about, because it is important for you to know the exact things you're going to be graded on. See, this is the checklist for informative speech that I mentioned in my earlier. And then this is the informative speech grading form. I'll click on it for just a second. But there's another form right here, informative speech student feedback. Those of you who would be giving feedback to other students, which is, I think, part of the people watching the recording who would be doing that, I think. This is the form they will use. This is the form I will be using to grade your presentation, to give you a grade. So this is what it looks like. Okay, well, it just kicked me out. I'm not logged in anymore. Anyway, I don't want to take too much of your time. This form is on there. I don't want to go back and try to log in because it will take me a little bit to get back to that. But I want to respect your time. And since you are early, I don't want to hold you too much. So anyway, make sure to take a look at that form. That's his evaluation form that I'm going to be using. Take a look at all the different elements or categories of that I'm going to be using. Part of it, there is a delivery category where I'll be looking for gestures and all of that, how you use your voice and so forth. And there is a category where it's really for organization. Was your speech well organized? Was I able to see your introduction, your conclusion very clearly? Were your main points very clearly laid out that people could identify what those main points were and so forth? Did you do research or did you cite your sources? All those things are on that evaluation form that I want you to take a look at on there, because that's what I'm going to be using to grade your speech. Okay. So as the last word, on next week, class session, you will be delivering your informative speech. I hope you have taken some things tonight that will help you to do, you probably were still going to do a great job. Hopefully you'll do even better after we've looked at some sample presentation and critique some presentation and look at some principles that we need to put into application in our own presentations. Hopefully that has been helpful, and I look forward to your speeches next week. And as I said, I will go ahead and look at your working outline and see if I can give you some immediate feedback to help you move on to creating your formal outline. Thank you guys. It's been great having you two keeping me company tonight, and hopefully we'll have more people next week to deliver their informative speeches.
Okay. Have a blessed evening, both of you.
You too.
You too. Have a good night.
Good night, Jean-Claude.
Good night, Gary. Thank you for setting up for me again, man. Yep. I appreciate that.
No problem. All right. See you Monday.
See you. Hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully.